The head of the United Nations Human Rights Group is calling on European states to be, quote, less callous in their dealings with migrants trying to reach Europe by boat. That comment came ahead of a planned EU emergency meeting on the topic and at a time of unprecedented casualties. In the Mediterranean Sea near Libya, rescue efforts continue after the sinking of a migrant boat over the weekend in which hundreds are feared dead. And another distress call came in today about more boats in trouble. That's according to the International Organization for Migration. So far this year, the number of migrants who've drowned at sea trying to reach Europe is believed to have exceeded 1,000. That's far higher than the toll this time last year. Sylvia Pajoli is senior European correspondent for NPR. She's in Rome now. Sylvia, what is happening in the rescue efforts going on?
Well, the rescue efforts for the big ship that perhaps maybe 700 or even maybe 950 people, we don't know, were on board, that has pretty much ended. Already they found 24 bodies and 28 survivors. The bodies have been taken to Malta for burial, and now the survivors are being taken to a port in Sicily. But today, as you said, there's been more distress calls, and the Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi says that already Italian Coast Guard ships are responding, both Maltese and Italian ships are responding to two emergencies off the Libyan coast. There's an inflatable life raft with 100 to 150 people on board, and another boat with about 300 people on board.
Sylvia, can you explain why there are so many of these migrants at sea right now and why the trip seems so particularly dangerous now?
Well, there's a variety of reasons. First of all, Libya, which is a completely lawless country, is a perfect place for the criminal organization, the human traffickers, the human smuggling operation. It's total lawlessness. There's in tremendous growing strife in sub-Saharan Africa, many places in the Middle East. There are many Syrians who are fleeing. There are Nigerians, there are Eritreans, there are Somalis. Many are fleeing civil war. Growing Islamic Christian strife in some countries is one reason. And the trade is so lucrative for the smugglers, they have no interest whether their cargoes arrive alive or dead. It's very different from the slave trade of old. They just want to get as much money as they can. So they have no qualms about filling boats with as many people as possible. They couldn't care less what happens to them.
And so this is the reason that we don't even know how many people were on this particular boat that went down, correct? The smugglers
exactly.
Are not keeping track, and they just put as many people on as they can.
Exactly. And what they do is they do one thing. They give the cargo, the migrants, the telephone number of the Italian Coast Guard to make an SOS distress call. And often, if it's mostly been the Italians now or the Maltese, they immediately come if they can, or they send a merchant ship or whichever ship is the closest to the area to go in and do a rescue operation.
And the status of that Italian sea rescue program, it's basically defunct now. I mean, what is happening? Because that was the hope that many migrants had relied on.
Well, it was been tremendously reduced because they had set up a big operation last year called Mare Nostrum, what the Romans called the Mediterranean RC. And it was a very big Air Force, Navy operation, a real search and rescue. And they saved many, many lives. That's why there are many more deaths this year. But it was costing Italy $12 million a month to run this operation, which with an economic crisis, it became a little too much. And so the Europeans supposedly pitched in. But what they have is a much, much more reduced operation called Triton. It operates much, much closer to the territorial waters of European countries and is not equipped in any way as well as the old Italian operation. And it only costs the 28 member states of the European Union $3 million a month.
Are most of these migrants coming to Italy? Where is it that they want to go?
No, most of them want to go to Northern Europe, where they know there are more jobs and where there are bigger, let's say, organizations, bigger groups of their nationalities. They have more contacts, sometimes family members already out there. But there is an EU regulation. It's called the Dublin Agreement, which has become a bit of a big problem for both Greece and Italy, which are bearing the brunt of all the refugees. And this stipulates that when a migrant enters a country, that is the country they have to stay in and apply for political asylum. What's happening is that many, many of these migrants, with the help of the smugglers, are escaping from the shelters where they're put up in Italy and southern Italy and Sicily, Calabria, whatever. And then the smugglers, for payment, obviously, take them up to the northern European countries where they think they can find a better situation.
And the smugglers themselves, how easy is it to apprehend them, and how many have been apprehended?
Well, just today, Italians announced that they have issued, after a 2-year investigation following another big shipwreck in 2013 where more than 300 people died, they started this big investigation and they have cracked down. They say they've discovered a big organized crime group. They've issued 24 arrest warrants, and through their wiretaps, they've uncovered what I just said, this incredible organization that first helps bring these migrants from their countries of origin into Libya, sets them up in these sort of warehouses where they're treated almost like prisoners. There's some very bad situation. They're beaten up. And then once in Italy, the other side of the organization helps them get to somewhere else in northern Italy. And it is a hugely lucrative business.
All right. Thank you very much for speaking with us. NPR Sylvia Pagioli in Rome. Thanks, Sylvia.
Thank you.
Well, back in the U.S., Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, known for his hard stance on illegal immigration, will be in court tomorrow to see if that stance has put him in contempt of court. He's accused of violating a judge's order that he stop some of his enforcement practices. Jude Joffe Block of KJZZ's Fronteras Desk, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network, has been following this story. And Jude, remind us where tomorrow's hearing had its roots, a lawsuit that dates back to 2008.
That's right. That's when a group of Latinos, many of them U.S. citizens, sued Sheriff Arpaio. They said his immigration enforcement efforts were unfairly targeting them, leading to racial profiling. The case went to trial, and then 2 years ago, the judge agreed with them. He found systematic racial profiling and put the sheriff's office under a court order to prevent profiling in the future.
Okay, and this was the court order. If he violated it, he'd face contempt of court. So remind us what that means, to be in contempt of court.
Right. So if a judge tells you to do something and you don't do it, you can be found in contempt. And the judge can order sanctions, like fines intended to force you to comply. So Arpaio and 4 members of his staff right now are facing civil contempt. But the judge has also said he could wind up referring this issue to a federal prosecutor who could pursue criminal contempt charges. And those penalties could be even more fines that they'd pay personally or even incarceration.
And so remind us what Sheriff Arpaio is accused of doing when this hearing starts tomorrow. He was told again to stop this systematic racial profiling. What is it alleged that he did?
So probably the most egregious violation dates back to a court order from 2011. The Maricopa County Sheriff's Office had a policy of detaining immigrants and turning them over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement for deportation. But in 2011, even before the trial, the judge said the sheriff didn't have the authority to detain immigrants unless they were suspected of breaking state laws. But now we know that the leadership at the sheriff's office never told deputies to stop making those detentions, so they continued.
And what is Sheriff Arpaio saying about all of this? And by the way, we remember him as someone who was incredibly outspoken. He was cited by a lot of politicians with equal thinking. He formed a posse, kind of an elite squad, which has now been disbanded, to crack down on what they thought were illegal immigrants. What's his tone now?
So this hearing that starts this week has been in the works for a while, and it's no secret that Arpaio really wanted to reach a settlement instead of going through with the hearing. So we heard a different tone from Arpaio. He actually came forward, along with his chief deputy, admitted that they did violate the court orders and they could be found in contempt of court. They were trying to reach a settlement, and so that's why they made those admissions. As part of that, they even offered to establish a fund to pay damages to immigrants they wrongfully detained. Plus, they offered to personally donate $100,000 out of their own pockets to an organization working for Latino civil rights.
Why the change?
Well, I think what's going on here is that the sheriff really wanted to avoid this hearing because this will be 4 days where officers will be testifying about who did what, who did or did not know about the judge's orders. I mean, I told you about one violation, but there are a number of other ones on the table. There are three violations. And so embarrassing details could come out, and potentially legally damaging details could come out. And the judge will be deciding whether or not to pursue criminal charges based on what he hears. So, you know, these criminal sanctions could potentially be on the table. So it makes a lot of sense that the sheriff would have tried to avoid it with a settlement.
Does anyone really think that this tough, colorful sheriff will actually be criminally charged and serve time?
Well, I mean, certainly a lot of people in the Latino community, that's what they're hoping for. Now that that's been sort of suggested as a possibility, a lot of folks believe that would be what justice would look like. I think it's very hard to see. It will really depend on what we see happening in this hearing. Certainly, the sheriff has been striking this new tone, a more apologetic tone, taking responsibility for what he did, in the hopes of maybe suggesting to the judge that he's turning over a new leaf.
And those hearings start tomorrow. Jude Joffe-Block of KJZZ's Fronteras Desk, a part of the Here and Now Contributors Network, will be following this. Jude, thank you.
Thank you.
Circus performance, especially acrobatics, is entertainment. It's an art, and in parts of the world, it's survival. A new documentary tells the story of two men who built two local circuses in very different parts of the world, the frigid far north of Canada and the searing heat of West Africa. The Inuit circus, in a place called Igloolik in the Arctic, is named Art Cirque. The African circus is 5,074 miles away. It's called Kalabante. It's in Guinea, one of the poorest parts of the continent of Africa. Both places, Igloolik and Conakry, Guinea, have desperately few jobs to offer young people and a dim future. The documentary is called Circus Without Borders. It tells the story of the improbable friendship and ultimate alliance of two key figures in these circuses, two men who became world-class acrobats and have started acrobatic schools in their hometowns. The film is made by Susan Gray, editor Andrew Kokora, and journalist Linda Machen, who introduces us to one of the two main characters in the story, Guillaume Saladin, from the Arctic town of Igloolik.
Igloolik is a tiny community of a couple thousand people where a number of young people had killed themselves within a very short period of time. It just happened that Guillaume Saladin, who was a performer from Montreal, had been visiting there at the time. And he went back to his circus in Montreal and began thinking about this, thinking, what can I do to help? And really, the skill that he had at hand was acrobatics. And so he began to recruit some other acrobatic friends, and he went back to Igloolik, which is the community in which he grew up, and started a circus called Art Cirque. And as it turns out, it almost seems, as it's been explained to me, that the Inuit are almost, I hate to say bred for it, but the Inuit are perfectly skilled to be terrific acrobats because historically they are very agile. They've had to be because of hunting, and they are short and quick, and they are just very, very strong.
And then we have this amazing link between the Inuit of northern Canada and these acrobats from West Africa in Guinea. How did the two come together, Andrew?
Well, Guillaume Saladin was in a circus in Montreal called Cirque El Waz, where he met Yamusa Bangura, who was an acrobat from Guinea.
What do you know?
Yeah.
Who would have thought?
And they were roommates, actually. And they both realized that they had similar dreams, really the same dream, in essence, of helping their communities back home.
And did Yamusa Bangura's community in Guinea have some of the same problems that that Guillaume's did in
yes,
the Arctic?
Yes, Guinea is one of the poorest countries. It was also there was a great history of colonialization, very similar to the way the Canadian government sent students to residential schools in Guinea. There was the French government imposed French as the language, French culture, when it was a colony, and then when they had independence, really, there was the economy was almost none. And so Yamusa was fortunate. He was lucky in that when he was 10 years old, a circus came through and they wanted tryouts for traditional Ghanaian acrobats. Mm-hmm. And through a lot of hard work and dedication, he was one of those who was selected.
So here they are on different continents with the same purpose, mm-hmm. to try and help the communities around them and the people around them escape from what were really dire situations.
Yes.
Let's get introduced to, through your film, to the two of them.
Since the first day, I heard that there was a great acrobat from Guinea who was amazing. We didn't even shake hands, nothing. We started to do acrobatics together, and that was awesome. Instant bond. He started telling me he has his dream of going back to Guinea, start working with his brothers, try to bring other friends, family. And I was telling him, amen. That's exactly what I'm doing in the Arctic.
And then we also hear from Yamusa himself. Maybe, Linda, you can provide the English translation because he's speaking in French.
La vie, c'est faut pas juste comme se tendre les bras, tout, et toutes les choses vont arriver.
What Yamusa is saying here is that life is not just opening your arms and then everything will come to you. It's about taking one step forward and pushing against all barriers. That's how things will change.
So what is he talking about there?
It's a reference to the fact that there are all sorts of do-gooders who come into the country and who try to help these impoverished people. But really, ultimately, it's up to the Guineans to help themselves. And that's really what his circus, Calabonte, is all about. He's taken kids who are orphans, kids who have no opportunity to go to school, and he's brought them into a school that he has formed called Calabonte, and he's teaching them that the only way forward for you is to take responsibility for your own life. And that's how things will change. That's how things will improve in Guinea.
And so how old are the kids that he's bringing in, and how old are the kids in the Arctic Circus, Susan?
He works with little kids, and he works with kids all the way up to their 20s. But I think both troops are dealing in countries where they're really at the bottom of the economic ladder, and they don't have a lot of options. So they play off of what they have. Gyeong started his circus in an empty swimming pool that nobody was using up in Igloolik. Yamusa started his on a marsh that's flooded half the time. But with nothing, they really went from, you know, novices to making it to the world stage, and that's what we were filming.
What was the next step, in this?
Yeah, when you start a film, you don't really know what the story is. So you find that out when you spend time with your characters. And as we got to know the characters, we realized that they were very positive individuals who did not want to speak about the problems of their communities. So even though it began with there's a problem of suicide in the Arctic, that was the last thing they wanted us to be telling. They didn't want to hear about the poor Inuit. They wanted to hear about the circus and the positive things that they were doing. And so it was a very long process for us to get the trust of Guillaume, who is the head of the circus. And one of the big dreams that Guillaume always had was to go and to meet Yamusa's family and to go to Guinea. And so while we were filming, the Inuit troop went to Guinea, and we were filming them. And we got there, and we saw how amazing what Yamusa was doing with his kids, and we saw how difficult the situation was. You know, Guinea is ninth poorest country in the world, and we saw that these were world-class acrobats who would never get out of the country. You know, something we found out in our research is there's a real problem now in these kinds of communities where the young people are looking at a lot of media, and they're seeing the Western world, and they're seeing that the people look different than they do, and they dress different than they do, and they have a lot of things that they don't have. And it's really hard for self-confidence and leads to depression and some of the problems that we encountered in the communities. So the idea of these arts programs is to bring them back to their traditions and teach them who they are. I mean, it's hard to imagine, but the Inuit were learning basic drumming and throat singing, they call it, and their own traditions, and then acting out, being polar bears on stage or hunting on stage. And Guillaume would take them out hunting and sort of teach them hunting. They've lost it, a lot of them. And the same thing was going on in Guinea. So it was really a beautiful way of seeing them become proud of their traditions, showcase that to the world, and then take that back to their communities. And that's a really important part of this film.
So they set out to do what we were talking about. They set out to make a better life for these people on both sides. Has it helped?
It's absolutely helped. In both communities, so much has been accomplished because of the acrobats. in Guinea. The money that has been earned by the performers in the United States has been sent back, and a school is in the process of being built for young people to learn acrobatics and general academics. On the Arctic side, the acrobats have, yes, they have earned money in their performances, but they've also developed a sense of resourcefulness in which they've built a black box theater in Igloolik, in which acrobats from all over the world come and perform for the kids there and teach the kids and inspire them. And there's a youth center now that's going on, and the kids are staying in school, and they are seeing a future for themselves, whereas before, as they explained to us, there just was no hope.
Actually, we can see some of these performers now.
Yes, absolutely. Some of the Ghanaian performers that Yamusa works with in Guinea were able to get into a circus called Kavalia, which is an equestrian circus.
Touring the U.S.
Yes.
So here they are on different continents with the same purpose, mm-hmm. to try and help the communities around them and the people around them escape from what were really dire situations.
It's two groups who could not be more opposite. Yamusa is short and he's black and he has dreads, and Guillaume is tall and he's white and he's bald. You know, the Arctic is the north and cold, and Guinea is hot and really extroverted. And they're really best friends and they're on the same journey.
The film is called Circus Without Borders. It's by Northern Light Productions. Our guests were filmmaker Susan Gray, producer Linda Machin, and editor Andrew Kokora. Circus Without Borders has its world premiere this coming weekend at the Independent Boston Film Festival. By the way, one of the great characters in the film is, as you can hear, the music, drumming, guitar, vocals, all performed by musicians from Guinea in Western Africa and from the Arctic as well.
It's Patriots Day here in Massachusetts. Thousands come to the state to celebrate the opening battle of the Revolutionary War. There's cannons and muskets. And then there's that other starting gun. Thousands more, 30,000 this year, running the Boston Marathon. And the winners are. Here now's Alex Ashlock is at the finish line downtown. And Alex, start with the women's race. Local fave, local runner Shalane Flanagan was really hoping to cinch it. What happened?
That's right. Well, she ran well for about half of the race, more than that, actually. She faltered at about 18 miles in the race, and she ended up finishing ninth. She finished seventh last year. Mm-hmm. But, Robin, you mentioned the battle on Lexington Green mm-hmm. earlier. Caroline Roditch and Marie DeBaba battled down Boylston Street here in Boston mm-hmm. in the women's race, and Roditch, who's from Kenya, edged her out. It was another great close finish in the women's race. DeBaba is from Ethiopia. So Caroline Roditch is the women's champion in this year's Boston Marathon.
It's so great when it's neck and neck like that. I mean,
it was
just
unbelievable.
4 seconds, just amazing.
Yes.
And how about the men's race? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, in the men's race, we were all watching Meb Keflezighi, mm-hmm. the American who won last year. He was the first American winner in more than 30 years. He finished eighth in today's race, but there was a repeat winner in the men's race, an Ethiopian runner named Lalissa Desisa. He won his second Boston Marathon. He won the marathon here in 2013, the year of the bombings, and after that happened, he returned his winning medal to the city of Boston, and it's now on mm-hmm. permanent display. He made that gesture after the bombing. So yeah. Lalissa Desisa is the men's winner in the Boston Marathon today. Meb Keflezighi, as I said, finished eighth, and American Dathan Ritzenheim finished seventh.
Take a look at the wheelchair athletes. American Tatiana McFadden won the women's race. She may be getting used to that.
Yes, she is. She won for the third straight time. And Robin, speaking of the marathon bombings, today she wore a singlet, a jersey, honoring Martin Richard, the 8-year-old boy who was one of the three people killed in the marathon bombings in April of 2013. She actually got to know a lot of the families of the survivors and the victims here in the Boston area following the bombings, and she honored young Martin Richard with her race today. And again, she won for the third straight time.
And the men's wheelchair winner?
The men's wheelchair winner was a man named Marcel Hug. He's from Switzerland. They tell me he's known as the Silver Bullet. And he finished first today and won the wheelchair race in the men's division. Yeah. Ernst van Dijk of South Africa finished second. He has 10 Boston Marathon titles, but Marcel Hug denied him an 11th. Ernst van Dijk, by the way, has more marathon titles here in Boston than anyone else in the 119-year history of the marathon.
But Alex, you mentioned the most recent history, and just have a few seconds here. You mentioned somebody wearing Martin Richard's singlet. There are signs all over memorializing the people. This is the second running since the bombing. People seem pretty defiantly taking to the roads.
Yes, people are still running this race, and always the bombings are going to be in people's thoughts. The second year after the bombings and 10 years after the bombings, that's always going to be a part of the history of this race and very much a part of the race today.
A lot of the survivors running and people running with mementos of those who were killed and running in honor of them. Here now is Alex Ashlock at the Boston Marathon finish line. Alex, go rest that voice.
Thank you, Robin.
California is America's salad bowl, her vineyard, a fruit basket. But as the drought continues, how will that affect our California produce prices? Should we pay even more for crops like almonds that use more water? Peaches use less, but should we pay more for them too, because there's a water shortage? Dan Sumner is a professor of agricultural economy at UC Davis. Professor Sumner, welcome.
Thank you.
And what are California's biggest contributions to the American diet now?
Well, fruits, nuts, vegetables. Some people don't know, California is also the largest dairy producer in the United States, so we export a lot of cheese and dry milk powder and those sorts of things.
Really? More cheese than like Wisconsin?
We are number two to Wisconsin in cheese, but much, much larger than Wisconsin for dairy in general.
Isn't that interesting? Well, what is your sense of how the drought's impacting how much of those food products come out of California?
It's complicated for a couple of reasons, and the answer is most consumers in the United States will not notice in their food basket and on their food bill much about this drought. It starts with the farmers in this state. What the farmers do is everything they can that's innovative and resilient to keep the water to the crops that consumers want from us most. We've idled a lot of cotton acreage. We've idled some rice, and we've shifted that water to the trees and the vegetables and the vines that people expect to get from California.
Yeah. You're saying we won't notice the prices go up in our market baskets, but is that the morally right thing to have happen? We spoke to one of your colleagues in the UC system, Professor Ken Starr. He made the point that one of the biggest problems in California is huge overpopulation. And he says if we start charging more for water, people might have to leave because they can't afford that, or it might drive the cost of products up. But that's how we should value water.
I don't know if it's a moral statement, but what I will say is economically it makes sense that people will try to move as much water as they can, say, from that barley field to that peach field. So to the extent that we're able to do that, and that keeps the price of peaches, almost all the peaches in the United States come from California, if that keeps the price of peaches lower, the market system, that makes all the sense in the world. Many of us think we should reduce the amount of regulation and streamline the regulations on water movements to let the market be even more effective.
What are you referring to?
Well, so for example, there may be water that's allocated to a water district in Northern California that says they're allowed to use that water, but they can't sell it to their neighbor. Well, that means they're putting on a crop that's worth, where that water may be worth $100 an acre foot. Their next door neighbor with, say, a peach crop may say, gee, but it would be worth $300 for me to have that water.
Right.
Won't you sell it to me? And the guy said, I'd love to, but the rules say I can't.
So if somebody's growing rice with tons and tons of water and people aren't exactly clamoring for California rice, that farmer might be better off economically selling that water to the guy growing the peaches, who will use less water and produce something that people are clamoring for.
That's right. So in a drought year, we might think of him as renting the water. He still owns the long-term rights to it. Now, that's limited by the geography. You can't get agricultural water from the Central Valley or from the snow-capped peaks over to the Salad Bowl, for example. That's two mountain ranges over, and it's just too expensive to pump water for irrigation up over mountains. Gradually over time, the price of water will be built into the price of the crops. But let's be a little careful about what that means. If you buy some peaches or nectarines in your supermarket in Boston this summer, oh, two-thirds or three-quarters of the cost of those peaches will be after the farm gate. So right off the bat, the farm cost is a third. Now you'd say, how much is that water in that farm cost? Maybe it's 10% of the cost of those peaches. Labor is incredibly expensive for growing peaches, for example. They have to be hand-harvested for fresh use. So now we're down to 10%. And let's say the price of water went up by 10%. So we're 10% of 10% times one-third by the time it gets to your supermarket. Mm-hmm. And you say, oh, gee, peaches went up by one-third of 1%. We don't notice. So yes, that higher price of water gets incorporated into the cost of peaches, but most of us aren't going to notice.
Do you think that's going to last into the future? We'll see little impact?
Let me say, I, like everybody else associated with California agriculture, hopes we get an incredible snowpack next year and great rains. So that's what we're all hoping for. It may or may not happen. Certainly, the prices of these icon items that we produce here in California, wine, everything from almonds to wine and zucchini, those costs would gradually rise with this drought. But we've got enough water to last a very long time. And there's something that people need to understand, and that water is incredibly valuable, but it has to be very cheap before we can use it to grow crops. And that's not just in California, that's everywhere.
Dan Sumner, professor of agricultural economy at UC Davis. Professor Sumner, thank you.
You're welcome.
And now, today in maple syrup news, it's been a short and not-so-sweet maple syrup season for producers in Vermont. The harsh winter meant that sap started running later than usual this spring, and now a warm spell has put a cap on the sap. State agricultural officials say the overall yield will be about half of what it usually is. When the season starts up again next year, Island Pond, Vermont, home to about 900 people, could become the maple sugar capital of North America. A company called Sweet Tree has bought about 7,000 acres in the Northeast Kingdom village and tapped 100,000 trees. Thing is, they don't want to make the stuff that you pour on your pancakes. Charlotte Albright from Here and Now contributor Vermont Public Radio explains why.
Before Sweet Tree started stringing its blue sap lines in its newly acquired forest, the newest maple producer in this remote area was April's Maple. 3 years ago, April LeMay left a corporate job in Boston to return to her birthplace and make about 4,000 gallons of syrup from 800 acres of forest land that's been in her family for generations. Fresh sap streams into a holding tank and a sugar house attached to a cafe and store. LeMay has invested in high-tech equipment.
So backyard boilers often come in here and they walk in and they lose their breath at first, and they, with envy, like, oh, I wish I could have this.
But LeMay is a relatively small player in the state's lucrative maple sugaring industry. Vermont leads the nation in the number of maple trees tapped annually, which pour about $50 million into the state economy. The biggest producer so far has just moved into Tiny Island Pond. It's a holding company based in Connecticut called Sweet Tree, and it's tapped 100,000 trees already, with plans to more than quadruple that in years to come. CFO Michael Argelin has been inviting state and local development officials to its vast processing plant.
Then over this way.
He starts a recent tour with an announcement that may reassure smaller competitors.
We're not going to sell syrup. We're going to use the syrup to make other things. So this way we won't disrupt the maple market in the state or in the United States. So we're not going to dump product just to make money, that kind of thing. And over this way.
CFO Argelin leads his guests into a room with a commercial stove, but dodges questions about what he, a chemist, might cook up there.
This is just a laboratory area. half the equipment's not in yet. We're still working on it, but we're getting there.
Is that for test products?
That's pretty much what it is, just test products.
But Arjulan eventually drops a tantalizing hint. He says his wife is trying out one of his experiments, a facial scrub made from the gritty maple sand left behind after boiling. Now that gets a smile from David Snedeker, executive director of the Northeast Vermont Development Association. He likes the idea of a big producer making something other than syrup and creating a variety of jobs.
It'd be nice if there's some spin-off activity from that in the community.
And there's more good economic news for this region. A Canadian company is trying to set up a network of American maple sugar producers to help meet growing worldwide demand. And it, too, is setting up shop in Island Pond. Both its warehouse and the Sweet Tree building used to be owned by Ethan Allen Furniture, which closed in Island Pond in 2001. Maple sugaring may not replace the hundreds of lost jobs in this cash-strapped rural area, but it's one way to sustain the same working forests that used to yield tables and chairs. For Here and Now, I'm Charlotte Albright in northeastern Vermont.
Put down your remotes. This week, Comcast and Time Warner are going to finally be sitting down with Justice Department officials in hopes of keeping their $45.2 billion merger alive. It's been more than 14 months since the mega cable merger was announced, and this week marks the first time the parties will sit down face to face. Wednesday's meeting with regulators will likely focus on possible concessions to address the government's concerns. Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from the studios of NPR in New York. Thanks for being here, Derek.
Good to be back.
Okay, so this deal has been going along for quite some time in the ether. What are the government's concerns, the FCC's concerns about the case?
The government appears to be concerned that this merged conglomerate of Comcast and Time Warner Cable, already the biggest cable providers in the country, would create a merged company that's just too big. And it's important here to be clear about why exactly Comcast, Time Warner Cable would be too big, too powerful to raise monopoly concerns. The problem does not appear to be that the combined company would have necessarily a bad effect on consumers immediately. After all, Comcast and Time Warner Cable, although they're both dominant in their respective markets, aren't often dominant in the same market. There's not a lot of overlap city by city. So their argument is, okay, even if the cable market is already fairly oligopolistic, we're not really reducing many consumers' choices in cable providers. If you're in a city, for example, with Time Warner Cable and four other options, you'll still have Comcast, Time Warner Cable, and four other options. But here's the problem. Cable companies don't just sell to consumers. They also buy from media companies like Disney and CBS, and they negotiate with companies like Netflix to deliver shows to households. And so the fear from the Justice Department seems to be that a Comcast Time Warner Cable conglomerate would have too much power in these negotiations, and this would hurt innovation and choice for consumers, even if it doesn't immediately make their cable more expensive.
I see. So they're saying, Time Warner and Comcast are saying, look, this will not reduce your choice of cable operators. It's actually good for you as a consumer. The problem, though, appears to be that this mega company, if they merge, would control most of the internet. So who would that cause problems for?
Right. It would cause problems for people like Netflix, for upstarts that want access to consumer households but can't necessarily pay for it. So, you know, one issue that's sort of lurking in the background here is this term net neutrality, which has somehow become one of the more confusing ideas in technology. Net neutrality essentially acknowledges that cable providers are a bit like highway toll collectors, and it says they have to treat all traffic equally. That means you can't preference certain companies, like, say, Netflix, by speed or by charging them more or less. On February 26, the FCC issued some new net neutrality rules that essentially treats internet access like a public utility. Congressional Republicans are now working on legislation to reverse that. But the upshot to this story is that there are a lot of people, both in government and without outside interest in this case that want to prevent Comcast or Time Warner Cable from using their power to charge certain companies special access to their infrastructure to deliver faster speed connections to households.
So you mean that could happen if this merger goes through despite what the FCC ruled back in February?
It's hard to know. I mean, I think truly right now, it's the thing that most onlookers are observing is that, you know, in the past few weeks, it seems like this merger, which, you know, a few months ago was, you know, 80-90% going to go through, now appears to be less than 50%, that that the lawyers are going to recommend that the government reject the merger precisely because of the concern that a company like this is going to have too much power over that final mile.
Okay, so with Comcast and Time Warner Cable knowing about these concerns, what are they planning to concede as they get together on Wednesday?
Well, the hope is that they might be willing to concede or divest of holdings the New York City or Los Angeles market. The reason that I think that this is a little sanguine is that one of the big reasons why Comcast, Time Warner Cable, wants to have this deal in the first place is to own the largest markets in the country. And so if the necessary concession is you can merge for $45 billion, but you also have to divest of holdings in your largest markets, that's going to raise an issue, I think, for the companies, whether this deal is worth that much in the first place or whether they expect investors are going to reward them if they go through with the deal if they don't control these major markets.
Okay. And briefly, Derek, what happens if the deal falls apart?
Well, you know, I think right now there are so many changes happening in the video market outside of this deal. The story behind the story, again, is the fact that the cable bundle, which used to be this sort of perfectly locked thing that a lot of people, including myself, thought could not be broken, now appears to be breaking up with, you know, ESPN and HBO and CBS all offering smaller bundles or over-the-top services. So I think Comcast, which has a lot of money, really still wants to make some sort of deal happen.
Okay. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, talking to us about the potential Comcast-Time Warner merger. He joined us from New York. As always, thank you, Derek.
Thank you.